few more seats here and up here if you're looking for a place to sit and don't mind being near the front. And then, of course, along the side over there, there are plenty of seats as well. I think we'll go ahead and get started here so we make the most of our time. We may have a few more people joining us in the next few minutes, and that's fine. We'll go ahead and just get started. So thank you all so much for joining us and for caring enough about the things we're going to talk about today to take the time to be here in this workshop this afternoon. We really appreciate that heart that you have for that. And I want to take a minute to just take a deep breath. We've been at this conference for quite a while now. And as you may have noticed, there's a lot of information coming in and a lot of inspiration too. And sometimes it can start to kind of mix all together in your mind and almost become overwhelming. Also, I want to acknowledge for each of us that when we walk through a door like this, we're not vacuums. We come in carrying a lot of things with us, right? We may be carrying concerns about home, our family, things that are going on in church. We might have concerns about our work. We might have physical pain. We're all carrying things with us. So I just want to take a minute to acknowledge that and let us kind of just have a pause to think about the things that we're carrying. If you'd like to, for this short time that we have together, you can even take a minute to kind of set those things down so that we can come with empty hands and empty hearts and ready to receive together what we have to learn. When you leave, if you want to, you can pick them back up and take them with you, but I'll leave that up to you. But thank you for being here. Whatever it is that's brought you into this room right now, we're honored to spend this time with you. I'm just curious. Mom Yvette and I did a workshop at 9 a.m., and I'm just curious how many people were also in that workshop. So we do have a few people that have come to the second one. Okay, thank you. That helps me to know. When we talk about people who are coming to the United States through refugee resettlement, we have a lot of questions and concerns and sometimes fears. So we would like to take some time today to just focus on, as Christ followers, not living out of fear but living out of love. And what that can actually look like, what it actually means to incorporate the healing love of Jesus that we find at the cross, what it actually means to incorporate that into the encounters that we have with people who have come to us as trauma survivors from diverse cultural backgrounds. What do we need to actually infuse into those encounters in order to make sure that we're actually reflecting the heart of God in our encounters? So we're going to talk about, in this workshop, something that we like to call healing encounters. Healing encounters. And what makes up a healing encounter? So I'm going to grab my... Oh, on this side. I left them here for you guys. One of the things, by the way, first of all, let me tell you this for those who weren't in our earlier workshop. Mama Yvette and I work together in several different arenas in Boise, Idaho. We have many, many friends who have come to Boise through refugee resettlement. We have coworkers and colleagues who have come together, who have come to be together with us in Boise. We both work, one of the parts of what we do, we both work at a place called the Center for Global Health and Healing, which is a local health. It's made up of two clinics and who serve primarily patients who have come through refugee resettlement. And we work with a team of 21 colleagues who come from various language and culture backgrounds themselves with refugee status into this country, and we work as a team together. So we get to work in a completely multicultural environment and learn together. So all of the curriculum that we put together, everything that we share with you here today, is actually representative of all of those people, that whole team of people. So they're all here with us, even though there's only two of us here right now. When we talk about wanting to represent the love of God in the ways that we encounter the world, we need to think about that we want to represent the level ground that we see at the cross, and we want to talk about that we want to represent the healing love of Jesus. By his wounds, we are healed. How do we live that out? How do we reflect that? How do we reflect that love that we've received that we didn't deserve, we never shall deserve, and that is unconditional and it is inclusive of everyone? How do we reflect that in the world? Welcome. So we're going to look at what we call healing encounters, and I'll tell you how we came up with that term. We're going to talk a lot about folks who have survived trauma and torture at the hands of other human beings. And one of the things that's difficult to hold about that is that there are no neutral encounters for survivors of trauma. I'm going to repeat that and let you just sit with it. This is a heavy thing to hold. For trauma survivors, there are no neutral encounters. That feels heavy, right? It feels like a lot of responsibility. It makes us worried and concerned about every encounter that we have. For trauma survivors, there are no neutral encounters. That's why what we're doing here is so important. And that's why this needs to be only the tiny little beginning of a learning journey. Because for trauma survivors, there are no neutral encounters. And this is what we call holding both. A lot of times we do this. I'll show you. So that means we're holding both. We're holding the heaviness that for trauma survivors, there are no neutral encounters, and the beauty, which is this. Every encounter has the potential to be a healing encounter. Do you see the holding both in that? For trauma survivors, there are no neutral encounters. And every encounter has the potential to be a healing encounter. The legal definition of what is called a refugee, by legal definition, it means that someone has had to flee their home. They have been forcibly displaced due to persecution based on five things: race, religion, ethnicity, social group, or political affiliation, and crossed an international border. By legal definition, if you look up with the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, that is the international legal definition that has to apply to someone in order for them to be able to apply for refugee status and possibly to apply to be able to be resettled in a third country. So there's the country of origin. There's what we call the country of first asylum, where someone flees to across a border. Sometimes there's more countries than that in between. And then the final resettlement country. In the world today, there are 65.3 million displaced people, forcibly displaced people, more than ever in history. About 25 million of those would be classified as refugees, people that have crossed an international border. Some of them are internally displaced, still within their own countries. Of those that are meet the legal definition of refugee, less than 1% will be able to resettle in any given year. Less than 1%. So millions of the world's refugees are not getting to resettle. They're in a refugee camp or trying to fly under the radar in an urban area. The average time from when a person is forcibly displaced, for those few, that less than 1% who get to resettle, the average time from when a person is forcibly displaced from their home to when they resettle is 17 years, average time. So when folks come to this country through refugee resettlement, by definition, they are survivors of trauma and or torture. Children in those families, a lot of times, are not primary torture survivors or trauma survivors, but they will be secondary survivors and oftentimes experience the same symptoms, the same struggles, emotionally and physically in their lives. So by definition, we're talking about becoming us with a community of people that are trauma survivors. And in order to reflect the heart of Christ, we need to learn how to do that. how can we create encounters that are healing encounters? Because remember, every encounter has the potential to be a healing encounter. The reason we say that is because when someone experiences trauma at the hands of another human being or other human beings, there are some things that are taken from that person during that experience. Now, there's all forms of trauma, and people who are resettling are not, of course, the only trauma survivors. Trauma is pervasive, and many, many of us are trauma survivors. But when someone experiences trauma, particularly at the hands of another human being or other human beings, there are three things that we usually identify specifically that are taken from that person. And the first one is dignity. When someone suffers trauma at the hands of other human beings, dignity is taken from them. Now, we all know that we're born inherently with the dignity that comes from being a child of God. That can't be stolen. But a person's sense of their own dignity is taken. Things are done to that person that they did not choose. Okay, so a person's sense of dignity. The second thing that is often taken from a person during that trauma experience is choice or control over what happens to them and what happens to their environment and what happens to their loved ones. So dignity, number one, and the second one is choice. Choice is taken from that person. Things happen. You had no control over what was happening, right? And the last one is trust. Dignity, choice, and trust. Quite literally and neurobiologically, the ability to have trusting relationships with other human beings is highly affected. It's very, very difficult for folks who have experienced trauma at the hands of other human beings to trust other human beings after that. And oftentimes, people's faith, trusting faith, is also affected. Many people can have at least a temporary faith crisis because of what it does to your ability to trust. A lot of times in a lot of our ethnic conflicts around the world, not always, but a lot of times the traumatic acts were perpetrated by people that the survivors thought they could trust. Sometimes neighbors, sometimes even relatives, sometimes community members. So the ability to trust other human beings. So when we're looking at healing encounters, if we think about those three things that are taken from a trauma survivor, dignity and choice and trust, right? We want to create healing encounters. So we want to create encounters where dignity, choice, and trust are restored in our encounters. I think we have a question here.
So in America, we are dealing with resettlers, that 1% of people.
Yes. Thank you for clarifying that. The question was, so in America, who we're dealing with here are that 1%. We are dealing with part of that less than 1% per year that are resettling. And of course, America is not the only resettlement country. Yes, many have been. So everyone, in order to be defined as a refugee, have crossed an international border from their home country. So for sure they've been to at least one other place, one other country of asylum, the place that they fled to. A lot of times in those average of 17 years, sometimes it's less, sometimes it's more. A lot of times conflict may come into that area where the folks have fled across the border and they end up going to another place. Some people have been in four or five countries of asylum before actually getting accepted for resettlement. Yeah, thank you for clarifying that. I appreciate that. Yeah. So what we're looking for when we talk about healing encounters is we're looking for ways to restore those things that were taken in the trauma experience. What a sacred opportunity. Imagine that. Make your heart barefoot, because this is holy ground. Every encounter, we have the opportunity to place a tiny little layer of healing in that person's heart. Whether it is someone that's a close friend of yours, maybe your kids go to school with these kids and you get to know the parents. Maybe it's someone you meet at the grocery store and just by the way that you say hello. We're looking to do that in ways that restore dignity, that restore choice and that restore trust. Anything that we do in our churches, as we look at, okay, how is our church going to engage with people who are resettling in our communities? Those are our guiding factors, because that's what's going to reflect the healing love of Jesus on the cross. Does it restore dignity? Which means we're going to have to get ourselves out of the rescuer position and look for ways that are mutual and dignity-giving to engage with people. Does this restore choice? Does this help this person to have the opportunity to make choices for themselves, or are we telling them what to do? Are we telling them what's best for them? And does it restore the ability to trust? And we're going to talk, Mama Yvette and I are going to talk about some specific ways that we can make healing encounters. How can we restore dignity? How can we restore choice? And how can we restore trust? These are the ways, by taking the time to learn. And by the way, we're giving you a tiny window. We sometimes do a whole day workshop just about this. So we're giving you a window. Please let this be the beginning of your learning journey. And it is a lifelong learning journey. At the end of the day, at the end of the workshop, as you're leaving, we'll give you a handout for those who weren't already in our morning workshop that's actually called A Lifelong Journey of Learning. And it'll give you kind of a recap of what we're talking about today, a little bit more information, and a lot of resources. But do some reading about trauma if you're interested in that, because honestly, we have to educate ourselves about that if we're going to have healing relationships with people who are resettling here through the Refugee Resettlement Program. One thing that you will notice as Mama Yvette and I talk, if you were with us this morning, you'll know this already, but we don't tend to use the word refugee as a noun to refer to people. For a lot of people, that's not a dignity-giving term. So we try to use words that are more dignity-giving to people who are resettling here. You notice that I often say people who are resettling here or people who are coming here through refugee resettlement. Because every human being is a human being, and there's a lot to that human being. So we want to be really careful. While the word refugee can be a useful word used as an adjective, refugee crisis, refugee resettlement, refugee camp, refugee journey, we want to be really, really careful that we don't overuse it as a noun to refer to people, because it can feel like a label. I have one dear friend who is Bhutanese Nepali, whose family came through refugee resettlement, and she said, it's like we have an R on our forehead. I've actually heard several people say this. It's like we have an R on our forehead for refugee that can never go away. So we want to be really careful about that. So I just wanted to explain to you, you'll notice that we don't use that term very often in that way. Our language matters. Yeah. So let's talk for a minute about dignity. What kind of encounters, what kinds of things do we need to be aware of to give dignity-giving encounters? The first thing is that relationships need to be mutual, not top-down relationships. Everyone teaches and everyone learns. Just because we were born here does not mean we're smarter. Intelligence is not measured in English proficiency, which we don't usually consciously believe, but sometimes unconsciously we do, right? My husband and I have a son who came to us at age 15 as a non-English speaker. And after the first couple of years of being in our family and becoming quite proficient in English, we were reflecting one day about what that language learning experience was like for him, what was helpful, what was the most difficult. And one of his comments that really stuck with me was, the hardest thing was that I realized that most Americans believe that you can only be intelligent in English. So those are the kind of things we need to be really, really careful of. Yeah. So mutual relationships. Someone might not be proficient in English, but they're proficient in some language that you don't know, and often 5, 6, or 7 languages. So here's what we need, right? We need a little humility. Actually, we need a lot of humility. And if you struggle with that, go back to the cross. Because when we're at the cross, the ground is level. So if you find yourself struggling with, oh, these people really, they need to just do it our way. They really need to learn this. I need to teach them that. They need to become more like us. Go back to that ground at the foot of the cross. Because it's level. And no matter where you go in the world, it's level. That ground at the foot of the cross is not America. And there's no language that's spoken there more than any other language. It's the language of love. So let's get ourselves into a really humble position. This scares people when I start talking like this. And that's normal if you feel a little like, ah, you're shaking up my world here. That's normal. I'm there all the time. Here's the thing. We can choose to be humiliated by this, or we can choose to be humbled. It can feel like it's humiliating, and that can stop us. We can bump up against this thing that says, oh, this makes me feel humiliated because I don't know as much as I thought I knew. I'm going to encourage you to push past, let your courage that Christ gives you push you past humiliation and go to humbled instead. Go to humbled. Be willing to be in that always a learner position. The more you know, the more you learn, the more you know you don't know. Relationships, in order to be dignity giving, must be mutual. This is not about us helping them. Nobody wants to be a project. Nobody wants to feel like they're the one always needing to learn and always being needing help from somebody else. And honestly, guys, nobody has more to learn than we do. So we got to get ourselves into that mutual position. This is not about us helping them. This is about all of us becoming us together. The world is changing. The world is changing. Everybody's moving everywhere now for all kinds of reasons. Thank goodness we're getting more richness of diversity in all of our cities. What a beautiful opportunity we have to be part of that whole reflection of God, of God's image. What an incredible thing, but we've got to get ourselves into that position where we're all becoming us. Everyone teaches, everyone learns. Another thing to know about restoring dignity, we need to be really, really careful about a thing we call condescension. Condescension. And that's where you kind of feel like we're the adults and you're the children. And sometimes, watch out for this one, because sometimes condescension can be really kind-hearted. It can be really, really kind-hearted and still be condescension. Now, we're starting to get into an area where sometimes we start to struggle emotionally. I do, so I just want to share this with you. If some of this makes you feel like a little stab in your heart as we're talking about this, that's totally normal. The reason it usually does is because we start to discover things that we could have been doing differently all along and didn't know it. Don't let yourself get stuck in guilt or humiliation. Let yourself be humbled and be a learner. So condescension can be kind-hearted and still not dignity-giving. One thing we've noticed is that if you're a native English speaker and you're with someone who isn't, remember when you're learning language, for those of you who have learned a language, you'll know just what I'm talking about. There's a stage you go through where you sound like a three-year-old. Because that's why a three-year-old sounds like a three-year-old, right? Because they're learning language. And when you're learning that another language, you do too. You go through that stage, and the only way to get through it is to push through. And then you sound like a four-year-old, and then a five-year-old, and then a six-year-old. And it takes a long, long time where your speech in a language other than your first language sounds adult. And so sometimes, unconsciously, we don't mean this, but remember, good intentions don't always equal good impact. Good intentions don't automatically equal good impact. That one is hard for us. Sometimes with good intentions, though, we're condescending. Someone who speaks English at a proficiency level that sounds like we would think of someone that talks like a child, sometimes unconsciously we don't even realize we're doing it. We treat that person like a child. We don't mean to. It's unconscious, but good intentions don't always equal good impact. We want to learn how to turn our good intentions into good impact. That's why the learning journey is so important, why we must get ourselves in that learner's position. So condescension, here's a few red flags in your language. Be careful of the word cute when referring to folks from diverse cultural backgrounds, especially people who just happen to be a group of people who might be a bit smaller in stature and who maybe aren't proficient English speakers. Good intentions, not dignity-giving impact. Watch out for the word little, unless you're referring to children. Oh, there was this cute little man from such and such a place. Unconscious condescension, but still condescension. And another one is constant use of the word teach. Well, I'm starting a refugee ministry to teach people how to do A, B, C about living in the United States. Now, granted, when people move to any country other than their own, there's a lot to learn, right? But what we want to be sure we're not doing is being ethnocentric. That, like, we want to teach people because this is the right way to do it. We can give information to people that might be helpful to them. This is the way things happen in America. Information, but not instruction. Be informational, not instructional. We want to be really, really careful. Now, obviously, some people are like teaching English classes or teaching orientation classes or things like that. Sometimes you're actually in a teacher role. That's a different thing, of course. When you are in a teacher role, you have to teach. But for most of us that are just building, bless you, that are just building friendships and relationships, we have to be really, really careful to not constantly be saying, we got to teach these people how to be oriented to the clock instead of relationships, for example, right? Because that comes out of a place of ethnocentrism. So watch out for the overuse of the teaching attitude. Yes, you will teach people things. They will teach you more. So make sure if you're talking or thinking about teaching that you're also talking or thinking about learning just as much, hopefully more. More learning than teaching. Those are a few important things to notice about dignity. Next, we're going to talk about restoring choice, and I'm going to have, in just a minute here, Mama Yvette come up and show us and share with us. But there's one little thing about trauma I want to share with you first that I think will be helpful. And oh goodness, we could talk for hours about this. But one thing that can be really helpful to understand is a thing that we call big T, little T. Is anyone familiar with that? Big T, little T, okay. So a big T trauma, when we refer to that, we're referring to the major trauma experiences that some people have. So a big T trauma would be something where your life or your well-being is endangered, or the life or well-being of people that you love or people that you're with, or you're observing that happening. So something that endangers your life or your well-being, major trauma, okay? And there are trauma survivors in this room. I know that for a fact. Little T traumas are the things that happen to all of us at various stages in our life that may be not life-threatening, but they kind of affect us. And you might kind of remember them at different times in your life. Maybe a time when a teacher shamed you in front of the classroom in second grade. And you never forgot that kind of that thing, right? Maybe something that happened to you that was really scary, either as a child or as an adult. And after it was over, you were okay. But at the time, it was kind of upsetting. You know, you were visiting a strange city, and you got on the wrong train, and you had no idea actually where you were going and where you were going to end up. Little T traumas. So here's the thing for big T trauma survivors. So folks that have come through multiple complex trauma and or in some cases torture to come and resettle in this country. For big T trauma survivors, there are no more little T's. For big T trauma survivors, there are no more little T's. Little T's are experienced physiologically and neurobiologically as big T's. This is important to know. This is why sometimes you will see someone reacting to something in a way that you think, oh, That was just a little thing. That wasn't a big deal. Why are they shaking? Why is their heart beating fast? Why are they sweating? Why are they trembling? Why is that such a big deal? Because while it may seem like something only worthy of little t to you, or maybe not even that, it can trigger a big T response in the survivor. And remember, everyone experiences trauma in their own way. So an example would be, a few weeks ago at the maternal clinic that Mama Y and I work at, a child pulled the fire alarm. No one knew this was going to happen. There was no warning. Many of the women who are patients in that clinic had never experienced a fire alarm before. And this thing is loud. If you've ever been in a medical clinic, I don't know, the ones I remember from school, I don't think were that loud. Maybe they're louder these days. Or maybe I'm just more sensitive. But it was that knee, knee, that kind of thing, super loud, and lights are flashing. Really bright lights are flashing. And the people who work there, of course, know exactly what's happening, and they just jump. And they start shooing everybody out of the building. And they're saying sentences like, oh, we're having a fire alarm. And if you're a limited English proficient person, what word of that do you think you heard? Fire. Mm-hmm. Could be. Some people might know alarm, but fire. Almost. And for many people's trauma experience involved fire. Not all, but many. But for sure, that loud sound that sounds kind of like sirens. I have one friend from Afghanistan who, when that fire drill happened, she was just out that door in no time at all and went straight to her car in the parking lot and left because of the reminder of sirens that go off in the city when there's an explosion in a certain part of the city. So we may think of a fire drill as a little t, or maybe not even that if you grew up having them, but many, many of these moms were experiencing big T trauma reactions during that time. Important to know and understand. Helps us to withhold judgment. So restoring choice, this is important to understand. Part of that is the trauma survivor needs to be in control of their own story and information and when they share it and when they don't. We talked about this a little bit in our workshop this morning. The trauma survivor must always be in control of that information. When anything about a trauma survivor's environment starts to feel out of control, that is so reminiscent of what started happening, the first realization that something's happening that's out of my control, that people are doing and saying and asking things that aren't in my control. Yeah. So one of the things that people for sure need to be in control of is their own trauma story, their own information, and this is a cultural difficulty for us, because we typically display friendliness and wanting to get to know someone by asking them about themselves, about their personal story. And a lot of times, what is it that made you have to come to this country? Sounds like a friendly question to us. And for a trauma survivor, it can be something that takes that choice away from them. So now you can start to see why, in order to engage well with people who are resettling here, we have a lot to learn. Because these are not things we would think of on our own, right? Yeah. But beautiful opportunities to restore dignity and restore choice. I'm going to let Mama Y come and share some of her thoughts and experiences about how important it is for survivors to be in control of their own story and their own information and why that's so important.
Thank you, sister. Thank you again. Hi, everyone. The family comes in different countries. We feel different way, and our trauma is completely different. Some people, if you come and ask, Mama Leah, how did you come in this country? If you ask me, I go back from the beginning what happened to me, and that's trigger. And I'm like, why are you asking me this? I don't even know. Why do you want to know my history? So it takes time to different people. I will give an example, like my husband. If you ask him right away, he will tell you. But for me, I have to build trust with you, because I had many years I didn't trust anybody, nobody. Even Mama Leah, we spend every day together. I still share my history, my testimony. I think a couple of days ago I was able to share with her a little bit. I do little by little, but it depends how much I know you and how much I trust you. So if you're working with somebody, just give it a time, build trust, get to know each other, and you will know when they're ready to. It's when it's time for them to share with you, because it takes us back, it takes people back where they came from, what they went through. So it's good to just to give a time, and they can tell you when it's time.
Thank you so much, Mama Yvette. For many people, speaking about the trauma feels like trauma itself, having the words come out of your mouth. And I just also want to encourage you right now, as we're talking about trauma, this can be a difficult and heavy subject. So for one thing, thank you so much for the gift of your heart that you're giving by sticking in here for this conversation. It's part of the gift that you're going to be giving to people that you love that are trauma survivors. Also, I want to encourage you, take care of yourself. Sometimes for some people who are trauma survivors themselves, having this conversation can be a bit triggering and difficult. So please feel free. Sipping water is always a great idea. If you need to get up and walk around or stand in the back of the room, that does not offend me. I see that there's a water jug back there. Making sure that you feel your feet underneath of you on the floor is always helpful. But please take care of yourself as we continue this discussion, because it can be a heavy one, and it's also very important. Thank you for sharing that. Yes?
I apologize.
Not at all.
Big T.
Yes, big T, little T.
When you are working with people and a little T occurs and you see somebody responding, big T.
Yes, thank you.
Is there anything you could do or should be just backing off? I don't need a whole lesson on
sure.
That. It takes a whole lesson, but
you're right.
Is there something you can do or no?
Thank you. No, that's a fabulous conversation. If you're with someone and you see them experiencing a little T as a big T, what is the best thing to do? Number one, be present. Because here's the thing. Sometimes people are afraid that their suffering will make it so that we can't be with them. Being present with someone who has suffered and is suffering, just being a calming, constant loving presence is a huge gift, because it says to the person, you are more than your suffering. And your suffering does not repel me. It does not scare me away. Because that's what happens when someone gets triggered, their suffering. So your presence, number one, and don't underestimate the power of that, just being a presence. It's really good. We have a little kind of mantra that we help ourselves with. We say, pause, validate, collaborate. So the first thing is to take a deep breath and make sure that you're able to think clearly and keep yourself calm. Because if you get dysregulated, we call emotionally dysregulated, you're not going to be able to be much help if you kind of panic. So pause and take a breath and pray. And then validate. So this might be in the form of, you know, I see this is really difficult for you. It might be in the form of, you know, I'm really sorry. I can see you're struggling. The term "I'm sorry" we notice has different meaning in many cultures than it does in English. In English, we use the same phrase "I'm sorry" as an apology and as an expression of sympathy. I'm sorry, but it means two different things, right? If I bumped into Linda and I wanted to apologize, I would say "I'm sorry." If she told me that she had lost a loved one, what would I say? I'm sorry. Same phrase, right? But completely different meanings. And language reflects culture, but in many languages and cultures, the words "I'm sorry" as expression of sympathy, not an apology, are much more highly used than they are in Western cultures. So, for example, if I am with Mama Yvette and I drop something and have to reach over to pick it up, she might say, "Pole sana, I'm sorry." She's not apologizing. I'm the one who dropped it. But she's saying, "I see you. I notice that something difficult has happened for you." Actually, since I'm older than her, culturally, she would probably run to pick it up for me. But that expression of validation, those kind of "I'm sorry" words are validation. And that's almost always the first thing that should come out of our mouth if someone is suffering. "I'm sorry." You know how to validate. Other words of validation, right? "I can see that this is difficult. I'm here with you." Being with is a lot more important than doing for. Being with is a lot more important than doing for. And a lot of times, once we've paused, we're keeping ourselves calm, we're praying, we're acknowledging we need the Lord here, and then we validate. A lot of times then we can collaborate, we can work together with a person. So for example, would it be helpful if we went out for a walk? Sometimes getting out of the situation that you're in, if you're in a setting where someone's getting triggered, it can be helpful to the person to walk out of that space in that room. But make sure that that person is in control of it, right? You're not telling them what they need or what to do. But sometimes walking can be helpful. Can we go together and get a drink of water? Sipping water is really helpful. If the person wants to sit, I'll sit with you, and we can sit and breathe slowly together, right? We're being with the person. A lot of times, you're not going to experience that kind of thing unless you're really deeply in relationship with somebody. But that's really helpful information to know, and I appreciate you asking that question. Yeah. So I want to kind of move through this because I want to leave a little time for questions. But restoring choice, the other thing I want to just mention about that is be really careful about stereotyping. Most of us don't think of ourselves as stereotypers, but sometimes we are. Without realizing it. So for example, especially if you know and work with a certain ethnic group or a certain language group, we will say blank are blank. This group of people are, for example, always late. This group of people, this woman who's coming is from fill in the blank. That means she's going to have a lot of kids. Not ill-intentioned, but still a stereotype, and not helping ourselves in terms of viewing each person as an individual. So notice that and be careful of it. Another way that we sometimes unintentionally stereotype is by attention to accent or to physical features that make a person different than us. And we sometimes think because it's positive that it's okay, and it can be really hurtful to people. This is a hard one, so let's take a deep breath. Attention to someone's accent, even if it's positive, is often not healing. Attention to someone's accent, even if it's positive. Even if we do jokes or drama where we are imitating accents or people's ways of speaking. No bad intentions. But remember, good intentions don't always equal good impact. And let me just say, humor, by the way. Sometimes we think if we're saying it to be funny, that makes it okay. Sometimes we think if we're saying something to be funny, and maybe those people that we're referring to aren't even present, I'm just talking to my friend here, and I'm saying something funny that refers to a certain ethnic group's facial features, language, accent, cultural habits, it's not harmful because they're not here. But who is it harmful to? Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. So I got to be really, really careful about that. And guys, surely God has made more things to laugh about in this world. Surely we can pass that up. Yes?
So is it inappropriate to say, "I noticed your lovely accent when you
Yeah. Thank you so much for that question. The question is it appropriate to say, I notice your lovely accent, where are you from? Depends on which lens you're looking through. Looking through the lens of somebody who grew up in this country, that would be an extremely appropriate, complimentary, and kind thing to say. Some people will be able to receive that well. For many, many people, being identified by certain features is part of their trauma story. Being identified by the way they speak is part of their trauma story. And being differentiated in this country, remember what we're trying to do is become all us. That doesn't mean we're trying to become all the same. I'm not talking about making us all look the same or be the same. But we want to be dignity giving. And until you know how that person feels, you're taking a risk. Because for many people, that's not dignity giving. And it makes people feel like you're identifying me by either how I sound or how I look. And that's not what you intend, of course. When we've all done it, let's just go ahead and acknowledge that in the room right now. Humbled, not humiliated. Humbled, being willing to be humbled. And this is something that most people don't know. Most people do not know that that can be difficult for someone. Yeah. And I want to say one more thing quickly about stereotyping. A lot of times I hear stereotypical comments, and then I hear us giving ourselves a pass by saying, I don't want to be politically correct. So I just want to take a minute. I'm not trying to make political statements here, but I just want us to think about that a minute. I honestly don't care whether you're politically correct or not, but I do care whether we're kind. I don't think for Christian people that politically correct or not politically correct should be our standard. I think we have a higher calling than that. If anything comes out of my mouth that could even be perceived as being judgmental or exclusive or not inclusive or setting up some kind of hierarchy, can that possibly be from God? Does that reflect the heart of the cross in any way? So I just wanted to give us a little challenge, myself included. Let's think a little more deeply about that. Be really, really careful about the words that come out of our mouths. So restoring dignity, restoring choice, and restoring trust. And we'll take a few minutes for questions after that. The good thing about restoring trust with people, for one thing, we want to make sure our relationships are long-term, dignity-giving, and mutual. Everybody teaches, everybody learns, right? Really, really important. When we are doing relationships that restore dignity and restore choice, that will equal restoring trust in most cases. That is what builds trust with people. When we're engaging in ways that are dignity-giving and that respect people's choice and control over their own environment, over their own bodies, over their own selves, many times that is how we build trust into those relationships. And just one other quick thing. If we really want to build trust with people who are coming here as trauma survivors from diverse cultural and linguistic backgrounds, let's take a deep breath together. We're ready to be humbled, not humiliated, right? We have to build relationships with no agendas. The only agenda is to reflect the love of God. Now, let me say this. As a Christ follower, it's never a question of whether or not I love people, right? As a Christ follower, that is not a choice we ever consider. It's never a question of whether or not to love someone. And if I love someone, what is my highest desire for that person? Anyone that I love? Yes, salvation, that they know Jesus and that they have eternal life. Can we just say that's a given? Can we just say that that's a given? We don't have to always say it, right? Because we say it a lot. But in this room, could we just say that's a given? Are you willing to trust me that that's my highest desire for every person to know Jesus? Okay, thank you. That's beautiful. Now I can take a deep breath. That said, we have got to love people with no agenda. That's what reflects the heart of Christ. It was unconditional. Before, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. If I am loving people so that I can fill my church pews, I can be known as a person that loves refugees, and hear this so that I can put pictures of myself with people on social media. Could we say that one more time? So that I can put pictures of people or myself with people on social media that show that I love people of other cultures. That is an agenda. When you are relating to someone, ask yourself, if I could take no pictures, and in fact, you won't. Don't ever take a picture of someone without their permission or use it in a way without their permission. Highly triggering to people. But nonetheless, even in our own hearts, this is not about how we look. It's not about how we look as an individual. It's not about how we look as a church. We want to be known as a church that helps refugees. That's an agenda. We need to have no agenda other than to reflect the love of God. When you are making friends with someone, ask yourself this. Let's say you're making friends with someone who is of another religion. I have many friends who are Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist. Let's say my dear friend I have in my mind right now, she's from Uzbekistan, and she practices Islam very devoutly. And if I ask myself as I relate to her, if I knew, I can't, but hypothetically, if I could know, she will never choose Jesus. Would that affect the way that I relate to her? How I answer that question is important, right? Because if I would say, well, yeah, if she's not ever going to come to church or know Jesus, then I should spend my time on someone else. Is that honestly reflective of the undeserved love that we've received at the cross? This is important for us to think about. No agendas other than to reflect the love of God. Of course we would love every human being to know Jesus. Of course we would. This is a holding both. It's God's job to save people. It's my job to love people. If those folks are going to be open to God's saving, it's going to be because they experience that love through us. People who are trauma survivors in 5 minutes will sniff out your agendas. This is a huge, huge thing we've got to have the courage to think about. No agenda except to reflect the heart of God. This is the tiny beginning of a learning journey, I hope, for you, a lifelong learning journey. I feel like I'm only beginning my learning journey. We have a resource that Rebecca's going to be at the back for you when you leave in a few minutes. We'd love for you to take with you. It's got a lot of links to things on the web and resources, books, recommended books for you to read. Also a recommendation to link to the RISE website, which is that project you've probably been hearing about here at the conference, through which you can possibly, if you're interested in bringing some kind of a workshop to your church or your school or your group. But most of all, keep yourselves in that humble, humble place. And I'd love to just answer a couple questions. We have just a few minutes for that. Yes.
How do you strike a balance between the hero mentality where we're the teacher and they're the learner, when many times they do need to be taught some things?
Yes, thank you. How do you give the information that's needed without getting into a rescuer mentality? And I'm so glad you asked that. It's one of my favorite subjects, actually. We tend so easily to be rescuers. And understandably, it's really emotionally satisfying, to be honest, you know, to feel like I'm the one that's helping, I'm the one that's teaching. Sometimes information is needed, right? So that goes back to that. When you're in a friendship with someone or whatever kind of relationship, hopefully it's a long-term trust-building one, when you feel like there's information needed, give information, not instruction. Because in that way, it's dignity giving. So let me give you an example. I had a friend a while back who was working on trying to help with someone who was looking for a job and trying to give some information that might be helpful in terms of job interviews. And this was a young man from a Middle Eastern country. And so for him, it's culturally and religiously appropriate to not have eye contact with anyone older than him. She was a woman about my age, and he was about the age of her son. And as she was talking with him, he was not giving her eye contact, of course, because that is respectful. And she became worried because she realized if he goes for a job interview and he doesn't give eye contact to the employer, that's going to be a problem, right? So she's telling me the story after it happened, after she heard my workshop, and she was like, I think I might have made a mistake. And she said, what I said to him was, listen, you know we're in trouble right now, right? You're right. In America, we give eye contact. You're not going to be able to get a job if you don't give eye contact, so you need to start right now with me. That was anything but dignity giving, right? And this is an extreme example, but I'm just trying to help you see the difference, right? So that was very instructional. This is what you need to do. What if she had said, so, you know, one thing I wanted to let you know, because it might be helpful to you to know this. I'm sure you've noticed that in America, there's kind of a different culture of eye contact than you're used to. So I just want you to know that sometimes for employers here, one of the things that they see as respect and confidence is when people give eye contact. And I know that you know, that's different for you and what you grew up with. And of course, you get to choose how you respond to that. But I just wanted to let you know and make sure you know that. Do you see the difference? Informational versus instructional, because we're trying to be mutual. Everyone teaches, everyone learns. I don't know if that's helpful to you. That's one of the things that we really try to work on. And I think this rescuer thing, some red flags for you to look out for on not being a rescuer. The use of the word my refugees, right? They're not yours, right? And that's kind of, that. If you think about it, that comes out of our mouths really easily, but it's pretty condescending. I'm the one that's rescuing these folks. Another red flag for rescuing is overuse of the word help. We've talked about that a little bit. I'm helping, as opposed to we're learning together, we're learning to become us. Another one I've noticed is I want to be a person who helps refugees. That I want to be part? Do you want people to have what they need, or do you want to be the person to give it? Because the important thing is that people have those trusting relationships. If God wants to use me to be part of that, wonderful. But God's got all kinds of resources. But when it becomes about me, about what I want to be and what I want, and I want to get any kind of identity at all out of that, then that's myself getting in the way. Thank you for that question about rescuing. Yes?
Do you have any tips on how to maintain good personal boundaries without making people think you're pushing them away
from someone? You mean like if people are asking, calling you a lot or asking you? Yeah, thank you. That's a really good question. Well, sometimes, of course, when you're working interculturally, you're going to be willing to shift a little bit in your boundaries sometimes. When you're not, I think it's really good to kind of go back to these things. If you have to say no to a request, look for ways to do that give dignity. So rather than saying, can't believe you're asking me that again, you know, I'm not saying you would do that, I'm just saying, we would say, oh, thank you for asking that. I'm so sorry that I'm not going to be able to do that this time because I have this other thing to do. Next time, maybe I can do that for you, or let's set up another time when we can get together. So we speak in ways that are dignity-giving. Make sure that our voices, our tones of voice, you know, there's more ways to speak than with your words, right? How much of language is it that's nonverbal? I can't remember the statistic, the percentage. Anybody know? It's a lot. And keep in mind that trauma survivors are experts at reading facial expressions and body language, because some people are alive today because they could read that. So our tone of voice, whether it's said in a condescending tone or whether it's a respectful, dignity-giving tone, is huge when you need to have set a boundary, as you said. It can be really, really important that we do that in dignity-giving ways. We talk about this a lot with people who work in various professions, such as medical care providers as well, when they're not able to give, say, a medication that's asked for. You're not always going to be able to give what people want or need. Get yourself out of the rescuer mentality and think about this is mutual, and then make sure that we're communicating in ways that are dignity-giving in our tone, in our choice of words. And choice giving, if you can instill a choice in it. So like, oh, thanks so much for asking that. Actually, tonight I already had, you know, some other things going on. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to do that. I could do that next Friday or the following Monday. Would either one of those work for you? So you're still able to, in a dignity-giving way, hold your boundaries, but also giving choice. And that those are trust-building ways to do that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes. Yes. Yes.
And specifically in regard to teaching positions and other situations where Americans are kind of in charge of various ethnicities and cultures of children, there have been a lot of stories going around about children, refugee children specifically, being genuinely afraid given light of what political situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's a fabulous question. Given the recent political climate, wherever nobody wants to make political statements here, we got more important things to talk about than that. But this is a fabulous, fabulous question. Very, very important question. Thank you. How can we make sure that we're doing all that we can to be dignity giving and to help provide feelings of security? If you think about the things we've learned about today about trauma and the kinds of experiences that folks have come through, you can imagine what the last few weeks have been like for them. For folks who have come here from diverse cultural backgrounds, where their trauma story involves something that began with political unrest, or with various ethnic groups being in conflict with each other, you can imagine what this woman is talking about that she's experiencing, apparently, especially with children. Actually, it's not only children. All ages are feeling extremely insecure. Mama Yvette and I, the last couple of weeks, have spent many hours with people who are being highly triggered. Their trauma response has been highly triggered because what's happening in the country recently with how strongly people are disagreeing with each other and so forth is very triggering for people. No one intends that, but that's what's happening. Very, very difficult. So, and a lot of times what we find is people ask us questions, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to my family? Am I going to be sent away? Those kind of things. We can't answer those questions. We don't know actually the answers. And I think it's important that we don't get false security. So we've been saying a lot of things like, I'm not actually sure what's going to happen. What I do know is this. There are a lot of people here in this school or this clinic or this country or this neighborhood. There are a lot of people here who are committed to making sure that everyone is secure and welcome. That's an I'm with you statement. I'm beside you. And we can all make that as Christ followers to anybody. I know that there are a lot of us here who are with you. We're here together, not feeling alone. I have one good friend who is from Burma, who is a coworker and dear, dear friend. And as this kind of what many people would call unrest in relation to their trauma history was beginning, we were talking about what might be helpful to help people get through this difficult time. And he said, I'm not worried about myself. because I have friends like you. Not everyone has that, he said. Not everyone in my community has that. People like us who have close relationships know we are not alone in the dark. And I think that's the key. We wish we could fix the things that are happening, and we wish we could make promises, and we just can't. We can help people to know you're not alone in the dark. We are with you. There are many people who care about these issues. There are many people who are committed to making sure that we're all welcome and we're all safe here. I hope that's helpful. Yeah. I think probably our time... Oh, goodness. You've all been so patient. We're actually 8 minutes over. Thank you so much for being here. We'll hang around. Please feel free to come talk with us.